It's time now for the Todd Leonard Show. Leave those negative stories behind as we focus on the positive and hear from those who give back and help others. Let's start your day with some inspirational stories. Now, here's your host, Todd Leonard.
Good morning, everyone. We have another amazing show. We're going into the world of college sports, particularly college basketball, the Seton Hall Pirates. I have a great honor today of having Dave Popkin, who's been doing color commentator with Gary Cohn for almost 20 years. And we're going to explore the world of hoops. We're going to talk about his journey of giving back, and we're going to talk about rock and roll and the mixture of all of that coming together with my new friend Dave Popkin. Good morning, Dave.
Hey, Todd. Thanks for having me. Well, good morning.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you on, Dave. So I was getting ready for the show, and, you know, I was thinking about, you know, basketball. I grew up playing a lot of basketball. I wasn't a star, but I loved the game. And getting ready for the show, I learned more about you and your kind of trajectory in life. And on the journey of giving back, if you'll permit, we always like to go through the evolution on kind of how you ended up where you are today in terms of your career and as a person. Because, you know, I was out with some friends last night, and we were talking about why I do the show. And I was just mentioning the reason is I love to understand why people recognize at some point in their life, why do I want to give back? Why is it the right time? And really to be a catalyst for the listeners. So let's talk about your upbringing. Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Neptune, New Jersey, and raised in Neptune City, a little town down the hill from there, closer to the beach. And it was a good experience. You know, I feel like I got a good mix of people in my life, you know, pretty diverse, and got to play sports. And, you know, it's a pretty traditional upbringing.
Right. So, you know, I know you're a very well-known, accomplished, you know, sportscaster, doing it for many years. And I grew up, like I said, I love sports. I wasn't the greatest, but I love the camaraderie, the sportsmanship, and also about it builds character. Because even when you lose, you got to be able to deal with it, right? And that's just life. You're not going to win every game. So when you were growing up, did you have certain sports that you gravitated to?
Sure, baseball and basketball. I wasn't a big physical guy to play football, so baseball is my first love, and I still have a baseball room in my house and still do baseball announcing as well as the basketball. Yeah, all of that. And then my basketball coach was honest enough with me. He was like, you know, that Popkin, he's not big, but he's slow. And he gave me a video camera instead of, you know, putting me on the team. He was like, hey, like, you're only going to get in the game if we're up or down by 30 points. Or you can be the video coordinator and help us scout and to be of more use to the team. And even though I loved playing and I learned a lot in practice, you know, from the other players and the coaches, I felt like this was a better choice for me. So my friend, you know, grabbed the video camera, my friend who had become my brother-in-law later in life, and I pulled the microphone off the camera and started announcing the games in the top row of the bleachers, and it became, you know, kind of a calling for me.
Yeah, so that was one of the interesting things. I always try to understand people's crossroads in life and how you go in one direction, then all of a sudden when you least expect it, you're starting to go in another direction. So you're a high school basketball player. The coach, from what you're telling me, was basically, you know, honest with you, didn't think you were going to play a lot. And you obviously, you know, at some point you realize if you're not going to play, you have to have some way to contribute. And when you grabbed the video, when you started to, you know, I guess, were you like videotaping the actual games?
Yeah.
So what was that like? I mean, was it hard emotionally when you, like, your friends, like, one minute you're like basically on the team, you're out there shooting, and the next minute you're with the video camera?
It was a pretty smooth transition, honestly, because I was getting beat up in practice and not getting in the games. And I enjoyed, you know, going on the trips and learning the game, but I knew I wasn't, you know, going to play. Our team was very good. You know, we had a lot of Division I players, a guy that got drafted by the Nets. So it was kind of a different thing. So it was cool because I made up rosters and I called the games, and the coaches took the tapes back and they're like, dude, you're funny. You should do this. Like, what do you want to do with your life? And no offense to you because you're a lawyer. I said, well, I want to be a lawyer. And they were like, don't do that. Be a sportscaster. So I said, okay, that sounds like a little bit more fun. So I did that, and all of a sudden, you're now a broadcaster after being a lawyer, and I'm now a lawyer after being a broadcaster. I don't know.
Well, you know, it's incredible, though, on the journey of life, it's just kind of what direction you can go. So from playing basketball, then you had the video, and you started calling games.
Yeah.
Did you, before you started to call games, and you were in high school, you were, like, I'm assuming, like, junior, senior?
What? Yeah, junior year of high school.
Did you have someone that you had looked up to already to kind of get a feel of how you would kind of do a game?
Yeah, I mean, Marv Albert and Bob Costas on NBC and Vin Scully, all those NBC guys, they were my heroes. And I really started to pay more attention to it at that point when I thought, okay, I might do this, and started watching the games from a different perspective. But Costas was so versatile, and he has a photographic memory, and he's just amazing. He can host, he can do play-by-play, all sports. His interview show later, I loved. Yeah, I mean, he's still, I think, one of the best out there. And Marv just retired, but those guys were great examples. And the Yankee announcers, when I grew up, Bill White, Phil Rizzuto, Frank Messer on WPIX, they were tremendous. You know, I'd watch those games with my my great uncle, Bill, and it just kind of seeped in, like how to do a game. You know, one of them would play it straight. One of them would be the comic foil, like the scooter. Oh, White, you a huckleberry. You know, and it all becomes a part of you.
Yeah, so even at a young age, you obviously had a love for it, and it kind of grew and really evolved. You know, I was thinking about, you know, I was playing basketball, and one year, unfortunately, I was injured, and I was on the sideline. I saw the game totally different than actually playing. You see something different. I remember growing up, Howard Cosell was my favorite. You know, I mean, talk about an announcer, extraordinarily bright, but he had that voice, and he just had a way to get in there, and it was actually very entertaining to listen to his shows. So in terms of sports, did you have a baseball team that you loved growing up?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I love the Yankees, but, you know, the Mets team, the 86 Mets team, and all the way through, like, I'd say 1990 was a very magnetic team. They came back a lot. They made the playoffs. They were exciting, right, with Dykstra and Strawberry and Gooden, Keith Hernandez, like Gary Carter, all those guys. So that was a fun team. But I'm a lifelong Yankee fan, and, you know, still follow the games very closely. I listen to John and Susan on the radio and watch some of the games on TV. And, yeah, baseball is a lifelong pursuit. You know, if you're doing basketball, if you're doing football, you can kind of parachute in and get through the game, right? You can crash, study, and learn it. Baseball, you need to have a lifetime of references, right? Because the game is long, the season is long. So it's a different thing. Like, baseball is an art, and the other sports are more of a science, you know, more of a craft. So, Yeah, I still love baseball. I'm going to be in Scranton next week doing 6 games for the Buffalo Bisons, and I still like going to the ballpark and doing that.
Yeah, I remember I went to there's a beautiful park. I don't know if it's still there. The Skylands out in Sussex County. Gorgeous, wonderful. And I know the Somerset, you know, they have a great local stadium. And obviously the Newark Bears, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But, I mean, I know you know baseball extraordinarily well. So You went to college in Miami?
Miami, Florida. Yeah, the Hurricanes.
The U. They call them the U, right?
The U, yeah.
And were you also still doing broadcasting in Florida, too?
Yeah, that was like I was. It was a happy accident. I thought I was going to be the manager of the basketball team because a guy, Sony Holland, from my high school, Neptune High School, was going to go there and play, and they said, okay, well, you can basically be the manager and be his babysitter because he's going to be so far from home. But he's the last guy that needed it. He was like a totally well-adjusted, great kid, and it would have been fine. He ended up going to George Washington and didn't tell me. So I show up at Miami. I knock on the door of the basketball office. They're like, sorry, dude, he's not here. And I walked across campus to the radio station, WVUM, and just signed up for everything. I hosted the blues show and the morning show, and I was the news director, and I became the sports director of the radio station and started doing all the games. And that's where I knew this is what I'm good at. This is what I like. And it was good managerial experience, too. because I got to assign out the games and sell underwriting and do travel reservations and real life. It was like a job. It really was like a job. And it was great training.
So, I mean, you obviously leap right into it as a young person, already kind of finding that niche in life, and you had a love for it, and you're obviously diversifying your different skill set, which you're using to this very day. Did you know back then that, you know, this is just your love and there's something magical about it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm an introverted person, but when I get on the air, the switch clicks, you know, and I'm just able to speak and to tell the story. And to keep people entertained, you know, baseball's a long game, and baseball was like one of the first things I did on the radio station at Miami. And we had a great group of announcers there then. This guy Todd Wright that was on ESPN, Dan Le Batard, who's a famous, you know, sportscaster, formerly on ESPN, my friend Jim Frivola. There was a talented group of guys that I got to learn from and kind of soak it up. So that makes you better, right? When you're playing tennis and you're with a better tennis player, all of a sudden you have to raise your level of skill to meet that if you're going to have any kind of a good game. And broadcasting is the same way. And I felt like, you know, the group that we had there made me better, and it was fun.
So, I mean, listening to you, Dave, you're very humble. I mean, you're basically saying that, you know, you admire and respect people that are really good at a craft. And when did you realize the importance of that, of really being realistic and saying, look, I've got to work on my craft? Did you have that as a younger person, or just as you became exposed to the industry?
I would say in general in life, you know, I had a competitive gene, so I want to be better, not just than other people, but better than I was yesterday, you know? So in broadcasting, you have to listen back to your tapes and watch your tapes. It's like singing or doing anything. Like, if you're going to catch the errors and improve for the next time, you have to listen back. And that was a struggle for me at first because I was young, right? I went into professional baseball when I was 21, and my voice hadn't really developed fully. Now, when I listen back to my tapes, it's a little bit more enjoyable, and I'm like, okay, you know, this sounds pretty cool. I would change this or that. Back then, it was like, oh, God, do I have to listen to this? But you have to if you really want to, you know, be self-critical and to get better. And I had a grandmother that wouldn't let us win when we were kids at any games, right? She would challenge us, and she would beat us at, you know, poker and parcheesi and whatever. And I feel like it stayed within us that, my siblings and myself, that, we wanted to get A's, like we wanted to do well and we wanted to win. So, I think it's been transferable, not only in the broadcasting, but other areas for me.
You know, it's interesting, since I'm a full-time lawyer, but I love doing the show, and I obviously try to get better each week as well, and I listen. And it's hard because you're always your worst critic.
Yeah.
I could have looked different. I could have put myself in a different position. I mean, I try to be as prepared as I can, but also, obviously, it's live, so it just you let it rip. But I certainly enjoy and respect the idea of trying to get better and better. So in terms of sports, so you leave, you go through the you know, Miami, and did you become a professional right after that? You went right into, like, the industry?
Yeah, one of the friends that I mentioned got a job in Sioux City, Iowa, as an announcer for the Explorers there. It was a new league, the Northern League. I was independent, and I knew 3 months before graduation that I would join him there as an announcer, and I got to do a general interest sports talk show on the big AM station in town in the afternoon before the games, and then we would do the games and do a post-game show. So it was really, like, immersive, right? I was on the air for, like, 5+ hours a night. So that's how you sink or swim. Right. You get good or you drop out of the business at that point. And we did big ratings and people really loved it. And I got to interview some of the people that we talked about before, like Bob Costas on the show and Hank Aaron and Bud Selig and Chris Berman and all these people. We would just call them up because there was not a lot of sports talk back then in, like, you know, 1993. Now there's 2 or 3 sports talk stations in every market. Back then there was like one WFAN in the country, right? There weren't not that many stations. So if you called somebody, they would do an interview. And I was lucky enough to, you know, interview a lot of big people on the show.
That's really cool. Like, yeah. You know, for example, obviously I've reached out to you. Ellen, who works at the station, said you're a great guy. And but that's also one of the magical things I love doing the show is I just like randomly call people or send them an email. They don't know who the heck I am, but people are very generous. And it's a really an honor when they're willing to appear. But you talked about some of the luminaries in the sports world. I mean, it's pretty incredible. You just like call them and say, you know, we'd like to interview you.
Yeah, we'd call them, write letters, like however we could get in touch with them. And we would have a big guest almost every night. And it became a thing, like in town. Like it was a small town. Sioux City is 85,000 people, something like that. Probably the size of Morristown or a little bigger. But there, it was their first time having a team in 40 or 50 years. And it was an exciting thing. And the people really liked it. So it was a great learning ground for me, being around professional players. The manager that we had, Ed Noddle, was very helpful and complimentary to me and, you know, would give a critique. So it was a good experience. And I stayed there for 3 summers.
So you've obviously, in getting ready for the show, you've covered a lot of different sports.
Right.
And I would be remiss, too. We're at, you know, WMTR 1250 AM, and you actually, years ago, had worked here, right? You did some work?
Yeah, there's a team, the New Jersey Rock and Rollers. It was an indoor roller hockey team that played at the Meadowlands. And the owners of this radio station and WDHA owned the team also. And we used some of the office space here to sell tickets and run the team, basically. So, yeah, I was sitting back there selling tickets because in the off season after baseball, I needed to do something to make money. So I sold tickets here and then I went and sold tickets for the Nets for a lot of years in the off season. And it just provided, you know, some kind of a living. But it was that's a hard gig, man. You get on the phone and you're like cold calling a list of people that went to the circus or went to the Devils or something like that and don't even know what roller hockey is. You learn to take no as an answer pretty quickly.
Yeah. Now, growing up, we used to watch my late dad and I, we used to love it. I know your great friend Jim Monahan. I know you were talking to him before, where you're doing the show. When was the last time you were in the studio? Were you here like recently?
I haven't been here in 30 years.
Wow. So let's go through life's mysteries. So I always like to study these things.
Yeah.
You know, you ever think you'd be dragged onto the back to the station by yours truly? That's the wonderful thing about life, right? You never think about it, right?
You never know. I used to love my drives out here. I was actually I was living back down the shore in some of my summers, you know, from college, and I would drive all the way up here to Cedar Knolls, and I interned next door at WDHA in the next studio. And Vic Porcelli was the program director and the morning show host, and he was very nice to me. And, you know, I got to learn the radio business a little better, the rock and roll business, and I'm such a big music fan that I just like being here, you know, being around it. So, yeah, I worked here 2 different times.
You know, shout out to the engineer MK, because, you know, we were regaling her before we started. She's like, oh, my God, you actually interned here and you were working here.
Yeah.
And she's been here a long time. She does a great job, MK. So shout out to MK. So in terms of the different sports, obviously you did some roller hockey. Give us some of the other sports that you did, you know, in your illustrious career that you were doing some announcing for.
Oh, gosh. I mean, 14 or 15 different sports. This year I did cross country for the first time, which was very hard. It was a video stream. We did it for the Northeast Conference up at Central Connecticut. And we only had like 3 cameras and they're all over the park. And it's hard to keep track of everything all at once. You know, the leaders versus the non-leaders. And it was new for me.
Cross
country.
Interesting you bring that up. My friend Dave, who just at one of my son's birthday party, he's rousing me because he just did a 5K.
Yeah.
I had to bust his chops, Dave. What was your time? You know,
yeah.
I had a good time. And, you know, obviously I'm doing the show. I said, listen, Dave, I'm sorry. I can't do it because I do my show, you know, Sunday morning. But I told him maybe next year. And I didn't want to show up. I do have a pair of sneakers, just to let you know. So were you a runner? I mean, do you know, like.
Not on purpose. Not unless I'm being chased.
Oh, okay. So what's it like then to cover exactly? What's it like to cover a sport like cross country? Because, you know, I drive to work. I live local and I drive through Randolph and they have cross country meets. And these kids can really move it. I mean, it's pretty extraordinary. But I never thought about anybody like announcing in terms of like watching the entirety of the race. How does that work?
Covering all these sports is kind of the same, right? You just need to study the people and the stories. The hard part for me for something like, you know, cross country or if I do lacrosse or a sport that I don't do every day, is the rules, right? That's the biggest way to sound like a fraud. If you don't know how the game is played, you don't know how it's officiated. So I'll do a lot of study on that, on the game itself. And then it's a whole separate set of studying on the teams, the coaches, the players. And I found that if you come armed with some good stories, that carries you a long way, you know, and that connects to the audience better than, you know, just giving their times and things like that. The cross country one was actually hard because at one point down the stretch, I think of the women's final, we lost the video. So I had to do radio of cross country. We still had the audio stream for the people that were on ESPN3. So I was calling radio of cross country as they, you know, jockeyed for the finish at the end, which was kind of in front of us. So that was a challenge considering I'd never done it before. But to me, like, it's a two-part studying thing. You know, you learn the rules in the game itself, and then you learn the who, like who's participating.
So like in cross country, I'm assuming the rules are that basically they start and they try to, you know, whoever has the fastest time.
Yeah. There's not too many rules in that one.
No. Yeah. And everybody should keep their sneakers tied throughout the race. So, I had another funny story about running. So as my friend was joking about is doing this race, and when I went to Syracuse, I tried to do a 5K. I figured, what the heck, you know? And I took one of those water break, you know, not water break, but like, you know, you watch on TV, they have the water stand. I take a swig of water. I choke. I got to stop running. I basically couldn't breathe. So that shows you what kind of runner I am. So, you know, I know you love baseball and you've been around, like, I don't know, for how many years have you been around baseball players and games?
30 years.
Right. So is there something you can tell? Because, you know, you have a certain vantage point. You're not playing, but you study the game, you study the players. And obviously, and maybe I'm wrong, but I hope I'm not wrong. But can you tell when someone steps on the field and you're like, they have that special sauce, like there's something about them that's different than some of the other players?
Usually it's by the sound. If a pitcher can really pop it in there and it hits the catcher's mitt in a different way, or the way the ball comes off somebody's bat. I'll give you an example. The Buffalo Bisons are the AAA team for the Toronto Blue Jays, and I've done, you know, 20 or 30 of their games every year for a while. So, you know, I go down to the field, watch batting practice, hanging out around the cage. I can tell immediately when the ball comes off somebody's bat, just the bat speed, the sound it makes, it's just different. You know, like we had a great crop of players in recent years, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Bo Bichette, Lourdes Gurriel Jr., Kevin Biggio. The ball sounded different coming off their bat than some of the other guys that were just like 4A players, they call them, or organizational players. It's just a different level of talent. It's like a, you know, God-given level of talent. And you can just, like, you can work your way into being a very good player. But to be a great player that makes the major leagues, you really just need to have a basis of talent.
So one of the things, because I grew up in New Jersey and, you know, Seton Hall basketball, Pirate, you know, I went to Syracuse, but I am Big East and, you know, way back. But I know there's a lot of exciting things happening with Seton Hall basketball. When did you start with the Hall as a broadcaster?
20 years ago, I had been doing some marketing work. I worked for these guys, Michael Rowe and Jim Lamparillo at Positive Impact, which became Positive Impact Partners. And Seton Hall was our client. And we did, I did a lot of stuff for them, right? I did marketing and email blasts and broadcasting like this and whatnot. So I got to meet all the people there through that. And when they decided to make a broadcast change and fire their announcer, they wanted to bring in two announcers instead of one. Warner Fusell was doing the games, and he was fantastic. I loved Warner. And they brought in Gary Cohen to do play-by-play, and they needed a second person that could be versatile and do interviewing and do play-by-play when Gary missed, do color when he was there, and just be able to talk basketball and have a conversation. Like, they wanted the broadcast to be more conversational, and they knew that I could do that. And I really didn't even interview for it. I just had a tape that I had sent that was like an end of a game. We had a game at Xavier one time, Tim Capstraw and myself, where we were just like analyzing the end of the game where they were like reversed a call, and it was just like a crazy ending. But we knew the rules. And the guy that was hiring at the time, Keith Myers, just said, you know the game, you can do it. And he just gave me a chance. And it was a non-traditional hiring, but it's worked out because we've had a tremendous partnership for all these years.
Yeah, you know, also, I know Gary Cohn, he's obviously a famous announcer, does New York Mets baseball, and you guys have a chemistry together. I want to explore that, too, because, you know, you've been doing it almost 20 years, two decades. That's a long time. And did you know right away when you and Gary met that you would have that kind of chemistry? Because it's like, you know, obviously it's a partnership, really. You're partners in broadcasting. Did you know?
It's like ballroom dancing, yeah. Right? You don't want to step on each other's feet. And it's somewhat choreographed, but it's also creative. Yeah, I think we knew right away. I think it sounded good the first year, the first game. And we've done pretty much the same show ever since then. We have the same sensibilities of the game. Like if it's a 30-point game and it's the first half, we can joke around and bring in references and, you know, talk about music or other things. If it's a 2-point game and there's 2 minutes left, I'm laying out. I'm going to let him call the game. And if I want to interject something, I'll do it briefly and I'll get out, you know, because I know what it's like in his chair as the play-by-play announcer. The audience is blind, right? I did the LIU games, and my engineer was actually blind. His name is Rich Kurlander. And he said to me at one point when I was doing play-by-play of those games, I want to be able to see the game. Give me more description, left, right, you know, where is the ball on the court? Court geography. And that kind of formed my play-by-play style. And it's similar to Gary's style. So I know what he's going for. And when I move over 18 inches and do play-by-play, I know what I'm going for. And I want to be really descriptive for the audience. And I don't want to miss things. So I'll get in and out as the color commentator to let him do that.
Yeah, so that was one of the other things. I wasn't really that familiar with the nuances in broadcasting. So this is why I love the show. I'm learning new stuff as well. I meet wonderful people like you. Between a play-by-play announcer and you do the color commentation, so being a color commentator, for the audience again, what's the nuances between the two?
Well, the play-by-play announcer has to say, let's say it's radio. It's different from TV. You have to say who, you have to say where, you have to say when with the clock. And you're basically just drawing the lines. And then the color commentator literally comes and colors it in and gives you the why and a little bit of the background. I almost see my job as the color commentator on radio to be the graphics that you would see on TV or the instant replay that you would see on TV or like some of the bumps that they use coming back from break where there's a big full screen and you're telling a story about somebody. I'll do that on radio as we come back from break. A little vignette that's different maybe from what just happened in the game. Hey, you know, Andre Barrett is sitting courtside. He was a great Pirate back in 2004, brought him to the NCAA tournament. It's like a focus, like a zoom lens. I'll zoom in and I'll zoom out.
That's a great gift you have. We're going to take a short break and be back in 30 seconds with my new friend, Dave Popkin.
The Todd Leonard Show is sponsored by the Leonard Foundation, whose mission is to support the children and families who are battling pediatric cancer and those in need of food and assistance, women's shelters, and other important social services in the community. They also proudly support those fighting pancreatic cancer. They feel it's vitally important to help those in need in our amazing community when they need us the most. Please join them in extending a helping hand and go to leonardcharity.org and donate now. Together, we can touch many lives.
So welcome back. We're with Dave Popkin, great announcer and a really talented person. So you've been doing Seton Hall basketball for 20 years. I know recently there's been a new buzz, a new excitement, right? Shaheen Holloway, who played for the Pirates, right, 96 to 2000, a guard, tremendous player, is now the new head coach. And, you know, everybody got caught up in, you know, St. Peter's Peacock's magic last year, right? To make it to the Elite Eight, nobody ever did it, a 15 seed. I mean, it's remarkable. And I'm assuming, you know, because you love Seton Hall basketball, you know the new coach.
I do, yeah. Shaheen was an assistant coach for a long time under Kevin Willard. So we traveled together, and I've interviewed him many times. And he's a terrific guy. No surprise that he's doing a great job already recruiting a staff and new players to kind of reboot the program. I mean, they made the tournament last year but lost in the first round, and I think he's the guy to take them to the next level.
So I was asking about baseball players because you've been around the game for over 30 years, and basketball, you've been around a lot. You've been videotaping games even as a high school kid, right?
Yep.
Is it something also you can compare when someone walks on the court and there's something about their game that you could just tell they're a standout? They have enough natural gifted talents they can maybe get to the NBA?
Yeah, usually it's speed. Whether it's a guard that can get by their player, their man, if it's a big man that has a little bit more speed than like a clunky person that's guarding him, usually that's the thing that will bring guys to the next level in the NBA. It's about creating your own shot, right? If you're a one-dimensional player where you're just a post player, if you're just somebody that can shoot out on the wing, it's easier to defend somebody like that. But if you're somebody like Jared Roden that just got picked up by the Sacramento Kings, just graduated from Seton Hall, he's able to go to a spot, create his own shot, drive by somebody, get out in transition. He has a chance, right, to make it in the league because he's 6'6", and he's mobile and can handle the ball. So you need to be, you know, a multi-talented player that's fast, I think.
You know what's interesting, because I do love basketball. I've coached Special Olympics for over 20 years. I just love the game. Something about it, I always loved the camaraderie, the teamwork, and just the momentum of basketball. It kind of is very fascinating if you really study the game. But how the court, it's gotten so much shorter. You know, I watch Steph Curry and some of these guys throwing up these rainbows from, like, they take a few dribbles over half court and they're letting it go. Now, growing up, I would be sitting on the bench if I was trying to chuck it up from downtown, but they make so many of the shots. Well, what are your thoughts about how the game is evolving, you know, the point guard play in terms of how they're really, you know, stretching the court now? It never used to be like that. Well, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, that's why they've moved the 3-point line back out for college, because there's such a proliferation of 3-point shooting. The NBA is all 3-point shooting. Even if you're 6'9", 6'10", you need to be able to shoot it. You know, Rick Pitino figured out early on that 3 is better than 2, and he's, you know, made his coaching bones on that for 35 years, and he wants his guys shooting more 3s than 2s because it adds up, even if you're only shooting, you know, 33, 35, 36%. You know, it's a good way to win games. And at the NBA, these guys are so talented and can shoot from such a deep range, you know, and shoot over their man that it's become a huge part of the game. You see teams taking, you know, 30 or 40 threes a game. It makes it a little less interesting for me as a viewer to watch the NBA game versus the college game sometimes because of that, because just like come down, shoot a three, and you'll see guys pull up on the break and shoot a three now, because it might be the most open shot that they get in that possession. They're like, I got an open three. It doesn't matter that I could have gotten a layup. I'd rather shoot the three. So it's definitely weird. You know, it's definitely different than basketball 10, 15, 20 years ago. But it's just, it's evolution.
So with basketball, and obviously you watch a lot of games and you make a living doing, you do, you know, a tremendous job with Gary Cohn. And you know the coaches and you know the players. You ever think about, you know, maybe I could be a coach. Maybe I could, you know, I know the game. I study it. I realize there's a lot of things in the X's and O's. But you ever think about that as you've been doing it so long?
There's a lot of things that I can do, but coaching is not one of the ones that I want to do. It's a tough life, man. You're out there recruiting all the time, dealing with, you know, players, AAU coaches and their uncle and their handler. And now with the NIL, the name, image and likeness, you know, players are coming to a school and saying, what's my package? How much am I going to make, you know, playing at Memphis or Seton Hall or some other school? Transfer portal. There are like 2,000 players that transferred this year in college basketball. So you're like a general manager. You're watching tape on all these players that might have played 7 minutes a game at Alabama, and now they didn't play, so they want to transfer, and you're trying to evaluate. It's a very different game right now, and I think it's why Jay Wright left Villanova, because it's become such a difficult job. It's a life suck. No, I don't want to coach. And a lot of people that I know that – coached and moved into broadcasting have much more work-life balance now, and they enjoy it much more behind the microphone.
I was just curious about, because you know a heck of a lot about the game, and I know you have to be ready, and you have to look at tapes, and you got to understand the game, and you're calling it, and I'm sure there's different sets near an end of a game where you might be wondering why they call that set versus a different set.
Sure.
Or the players simply didn't follow what the coach wanted to do. So one of the most important things about the show was about giving back. And I know that a number of years ago, you got really involved with the Nutley Family Services. And it means so much when I've guys like you with your gifts and your talent are giving back. So tell us about, you know, when you realized that, you know, it was important to lift up the community the way you thought you could help out.
Well, my wife, Cindy, had been donating our turkey every year at Thanksgiving and food sometimes to the food pantry in town, which is part of it was the Red Cross at the time and then Nutley Family Service Bureau, which has been there for over 100 years, helping out the community. And I manage walks and runs and different events as my day job at Hilltop Management. And we would often get stuff after the event, fruit, potato chips, water, whatever, afterwards it's left over, and I didn't want to waste it, so I'd bring it to the food pantry and drop it off. So one day, the executive director, Eileen Painter, grabbed me by the ear and was like, hey, who are you and why are you bringing me all this stuff? And we got to talking about the needs of the organization, and the organization was really, you know, trying to rebuild itself and figure out what it wanted to be and how it could best serve the community. And she knew that we needed more volunteers, more publicity, needed to get a little younger. So I said to her, let's do a rock concert. You know, I play in a band. We'll play for free. We'll get a venue and we'll just raise money and raise awareness. And she was like, sold. She greenlit it immediately. And, you know, that was 6 years ago at this point. And I've gotten more involved each year. I'm on the board now and, you know, help lead various committees, you know, event committees and things like that. And it's been a labor of love because the organization does so many great things, mental health, counseling services, food pantry, case management. It's really a hub in our town that, you know, the schools, the police department, different organizations refer to us when they have issues that they need help with through the pandemic. I mean, we're a really important organization in town.
So, I mean, the Nutley Family Services, they're doing so many wonderful things in the community. And ironically, because this is, you know, DHA is the FM dial here, right? Mm-hmm. And I know your great friend Jim Monahan is, you know, tremendously talented announcer here. You know, he really, really knows his music. And music, you know, I know in advance of the show we were talking, that part of the brain, whatever that part is, and mine's underdeveloped, but I do like music. Can't say I'm an avid collector, but I know that you have two bands, not one, but two, the Attic and the Porch Rockers. So I think you play the drums?
Yeah, I play the drums, but I sing in both of those bands now.
Right. Yeah. So what's it like? You have some friends, you get together and you jam and you do these concerts, right?
We do. Yeah, we do a Rock Hunger concert every year. We just had our fifth Rock Hunger for Nutley Family Service Bureau. At Old Canal Inn and raised about $10,000 for the pantry. And both of those bands that you mentioned played along with three other bands. And people love it. You know, we sit outside and it's a nice day. And it's good to be with your community, right? It's one of the reasons why I've really enjoyed Nutley Family Service Bureau because I don't have kids and I didn't know anybody in my town. So it's been a good opportunity for me to meet people and to make connections, you know, and this concert has been a good way. And the bands have been so generous to donate their time because it takes a lot of, you know, rehearsal and planning. And it's like herding cats with people in rock and roll to get them all in the same place at the same time. So, yeah, it's a labor of love. It's been fun.
So what's it like when you look out at the audience and you're rocking it out, you and your buddies, and you're raising money? I mean, that's remarkable, and God bless you for doing that. What's that feeling like, Dave, when you look out and you see people really with the common bond? What's that feeling?
It's gratifying. Fear, adrenaline, joy. It's all of it. You know, it's really a rush. And it's like broadcasting. Like the more prepared you are and the more that you've done it, the more that you can do it and be good at it and be comfortable. So this year I felt more comfortable than last year. And it's a great feeling, really. And the camaraderie of the people on stage and the communication, you know, verbal, nonverbal, making sure that you're all on the same page. How are we going to end this song? Right. You have to be really in the moment.
You have to be certainly focused. So I know you're a huge fan of The Boss, Bruce Springsteen. I mean,
huge.
Maybe that's an understatement. All right. So when did you first, gravitate to The Boss, because I'm being born and raised in New Jersey. I mean, you know, he's obviously a world-famous Jersey guy. But when did you first, listen to The Boss?
The first song that I remembered was Hungry Heart. You know, it just was such a great pop hit. And I was a kid at the time, and my mother would have me listen to pop music, right? Elton John and the Eagles, and this Bruce Springsteen was on the radio. That was his first real hit, I think. I mean, other than Born to Run, but Hungry Heart was a crossover, crossed over to pop radio. So, and then I got Nebraska after that. That was a real awakening because it was a totally different album. It's very spare, acoustic, dark writing, but I've always liked good writers of any kind, whether it's TV shows or novels or music. And that was a really well-written record. I mean, it's one of the greatest of all time. And then he comes out with Born in the USA, and I'm, totally hooked, because there's one hit after another on that album, and then Tunnel of Love, which is maybe my favorite Bruce album, along with Darkness. So, I started to see him in concert on the Human Touch and Lucky Town tour, which is like 92. And I've seen him, I'm so grateful that I've seen him like 100 times since then. And he's the best. I've gotten to see so many people over the years, and just his band leading, his singing, the storytelling. I mean, the message, behind the music, he's the greatest.
I watched him when I went to Syracuse at the Carrier Dome. He rocked it out for over like 3 hours. I mean, this is a long time ago.
He still does.
Yeah. It's pretty awesome. That was all that energy.
He played last night at Glastonbury. He played with Paul McCartney.
Really?
Showed up in England and played. He and Dave Grohl. So.
Yeah. No, I know. There's always these studies at the Stone Pony, and never was so fortunate to see him there. But I mean, he's one of the real down to earth guys. I know your dog also, Clarence.
Clarence. he's named after a big man, Clarence Clemens. He's listening today. I'm sure.
I hope he's not barking right now. I don't want to find out he's barking. You mentioned your wife Cindy, and tell us about her impact on your life, about the idea of giving back. I mean, to be married to a woman that really understands, the importance of the humanity, of the human condition.
Yeah, I mean, wonderful person. She gets it because she's a school teacher, so she gives back to kids every day. Was involved since, we've been together for over 30 years, and she started with an organization, Christmas is for Children, back then, about 30 years ago, which provides, toys to kids in need in this area, basically from Morristown to the Bronx and further south as well. So I got a little involved with that, but she became like the local director of that charity, volunteer run. I've followed that example, and, whether it's, Nutley Family Service Bureau or other things, in my life, we've been lucky. Like we get to work and we have benefits and we have paychecks, and we have family and friends, and a lot of people do not have all of those things, right? So that when you can give the gift of your, we say at Nutley Family Service Bureau, time, talent, and treasure. Sometimes you can give one, sometimes you can give all three. I'm lucky enough that I can give all three right now and try to make an impact for people that, might be going through a hard time.
Sure, that's a beautiful thing, Dave, and your wife. You guys are wonderful people. So you came up with Rock Hunger.
Yeah.
Rock Hunger. And you had written about, if rock and roll has the power to change the world, it certainly has enough power to change one community at a time by helping raise money for your local food bank and helping to feed the families of your community. It's a beautiful concept, and there's a lot of listeners that love rock and roll, and there's something about it. There's an energy to it, and it does change people, change their mood, and change their spirit. How'd you come up with the phrase rock hunger?
I don't know. I mean, it's something that I wanted to incorporate the music aspect, and I wanted to incorporate, the need to eradicate it and to rock it out, to bust it. And it just clicked. And, you know, I want to expand it beyond Nutley. That's like the next frontier. I mean, there are people like Bill Ayers at World Hunger Year, or Springsteen, or the guys that started Farm Aid, people like that that are trying to solve this issue, you know, in this country. And I'm happy to help any community that has a food bank or a food pantry take the Rock Hunger brand and concept, and we'll do the artwork for you, help you find the bands, whatever, and do a concert in your town. It's easy. And people love it. And, you know, to raise an extra, you know, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 for your local pantry, it goes a long way. You can buy perishables. You can buy new refrigerators. Like, there's all kinds of things that a pantry needs to serve the community. And there are still people that need it. You know, I mean, we have, you know, almost 400 people, you know, at Nutley Family Service Bureau that take advantage of this. During the pandemic, it was more. And, you know, when we provided school lunches, when the schools couldn't do it, it was even more than that. So the need is out there. Like, even though unemployment is low, you know, there is still a need, and there are still people going hungry every night in this country. And it's inexcusable. In a country like this. So if I can do my little part, you know, town by town, to help raise a little money through something that I love, music, why not do that?
No, absolutely. We've had some wonderful guests on talking about that, about, you know, basically there's a need. People don't realize it, but there's people sadly don't have enough food, and it's right in front of us. You don't even realize it, but right here in affluent Morris County, most affluent communities in the country, there's people that don't have enough food on their table. So it's a wonderful, beautiful thing that you're doing to raise money and awareness for it. If someone wants to reach you and support Rock Hunger, how do they do that, Dave?
Rock-hunger.com. Or you can go to the NutleyFamily.org site and see what we've done there in the past. You know, see pictures and videos and the people that sponsor it. You know, we had over 200 people at the event the last couple of years, and they're walking testimonials. You know, they enjoyed it, and they gave back, and it's a cool thing. You know, I definitely encourage people to get involved with it if they can.
So that was one of the other things is, you know, you're extraordinarily busy, and but you're still giving back. How do you balance life? I always go back to the, you know, Miyagi and the Karate Kid, one of my favorite quotes for people that tune in regularly to the show. I like bringing that up because that is really life's mysteries, is to try to find the right balance, right? We all have to pay bills, but we need to give back. We have to do more to lift others up, because it can't just be about you. You want to leave a legacy. You want to do something that people remember you for doing something good. So how do you find the balance in life? Because you're traveling a lot. You have a lot of different, you know, commitments, Hilltop Management. You're doing other things, and you're still finding the time. How do you do it?
I don't know. It's a big challenge. And they say, you know, if you want something done, give it to a busy person. And I feel like I'm lucky that people want me to do stuff, right? Whether it's, you know, manage their event, call their game, help out with whatever their project is. They know that I got a guy, right? Or that I'm able to provide my insight and my experience and my energy. So I consider myself fortunate to be in that position, you know, that I'm in need, you know, for some of these things. But you have to take care of yourself and your family and your dog and your house and all these things, because if you don't have that basis, you know, and if you're not strong, personally, then you can't be of use to someone else. Right. So that you need to find that balance. I know you're a big, you know, workout guy, and I used to be as well. I've fallen off the wagon in that regard, but you have to take care of yourself so that you have the energy so you have like the mental bandwidth to be able to do stuff like that. Otherwise, it's not really possible.
Well, God bless you for finding the time. But it is interesting that people that are the busiest are the ones really just doing so many different things, and that's why they're so busy. I know you're involved in a sports broadcasting camp, and that's also a fascinating subject, because I love the idea of imparting knowledge to others. You know, it's really important to pass on your craft. Tell us about sports broadcasting camp a little bit.
Well, sportsbroadcastingcamp.com is where people can learn more about it. We do it every year, non-pandemic, at Montclair State University at their School of Communication and Media. My buddy Tim Capstraw, who broadcasts the Brooklyn Nets games on WFAN, is my partner in that. And a guy, Dave Cerotti, a friend of mine, owns the camp. And Bruce Beck and Ian Eagle, two famous sportscasters, were the main teachers the first 15 years. And then like Chris Carino and Tim and myself and other people have kind of taken the reins of the camp, and it's great. It's really gratifying. The kids gain so much confidence from day one to day five. We put them in front of the microphone like this in radio studios, TV studios. We put the lights on them, let them read off teleprompters. We bring in all kinds of big guest speakers. Mike Francesa is going to come in this year, Kenny Albert, all kinds of people like that to speak to the kids and give them like the inside scoop on what it's like to be a broadcaster and what it takes to get to the next level. So we'll have, you know, 30-40 kids over at Montclair State the week of July 18th. And it's the 21st year of the camp. It's my 20th year with the camp. And we were able to kind of soldier through and do virtual camps during the pandemic. And this is our first time in person in 3 years. So we're really looking forward to it. And it's a great weekend. My nephew is now old enough. He's 13, Jack. He's going to come up from Atlanta and go to the camp this year. So it's going to be cool.
So how old are the kids that are participating?
Like 11 to 18. And we break them up into two classes.
That's pretty wild. I remember talking about basketball. I went to Pocono Mountain Basketball Camp way back in the day. The late Jim Valvano.
Sure.
NC State, famous coach. Actually was one of the guys that came on. He wheeled into the gym on a skateboard, a stuffed rat. Now, I mean, talk about like something off the charts. And everybody, all the campers, I was like 13, and we're all like, who the heck is this guy? Not realizing he was going to turn out to be one of the great coaches. Sadly passed away too young of an age, but he talked about the mentality. But the reason why I remember it was he was teaching, but he was so passionate about it. And they had Hank Slider, a great free throw shooter, like set some world record and made like a crazy amount of shots in a row. But I love the fact you're using your gifts and teaching the young kids how to do it. Do you get any feedback from the kids? You've been doing it so long that they're actually, you know, they've evolved and become more known in the industry.
Oh, yeah. We've had hundreds of kids and I've kept in contact with them and they've gone on to broadcast in college and professionally. Justin Shackle is a guy that I love that went to the camp, went to Fordham, and he filled in for John Sterling on the radio for the Yankee games like 2 weeks ago and did a great job. And we've had many examples like that, like former interns at the camp, you know, have gone on to become the biggest broadcasters in the business, like Jared Greenberg on TNT, Ed Cohen, the voice of the Knicks, all these people that have been associated with the camp, either as, you know, students, interns, counselors, guest speakers. It's like a who's who, really, of broadcasting. So it's been a great networking opportunity for me, and I've made a lot of friends through it. And the kids, you know, keep in contact, and I review their tapes and, you know, write them college letters and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's not just 1 week. It's kind of for life.
That's critical. I mean, you're using your gift. I say it over and over, but you're taking your knowledge and you're not just keeping it to yourself. And then these kids are benefiting and you're also benefiting, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That process.
And I don't want to hear bad sportscasting when I hear games out there. I want to hear people that do it the right way. So if I can teach them how to do it the right way and then enjoy the game when they're doing it, that's great for me.
So, you know, I was asking about the world of sports, you know, the crack of a bat or the sound of a mitt when someone's throwing a 95 mile per hour heater, or someone on the basketball court just got an extra gear, having no one can really, you know, match up with them. What's it like in broadcasting? There's anything like, you know, let's say a youngster comes into this camp, and then is there anything that you like look for that kind of like sets that person apart?
It's poise, it's personality, really. And I have a guy that I'm friendly with, John Fanta. Okay, John went to Seton Hall, and he is now a broadcaster and a writer for Fox Sports. He does stuff for the Big East. And he is not like the traditional sound or look of a sportscaster, but he's tremendous. And people love him because he has the passion and because he's identifiable and he's a character, right? And people are like, oh, I like that guy, right? So that's a good quality to have, whatever that is, right? And everybody has a different thing. Susan Waldman, is obviously very different than John Sterling. But you can tell the difference, you know, and you can identify them immediately. And some people might like them, some people might hate them, but they're memorable. And being memorable and entertaining on the air is something that's hard to teach, right? You can teach them the basics, the ABCs, what to do, how to do it. But the ones that really take it to the next level, like the network level, it's like the baseball player where it comes off their bat 100 miles an hour. It's the same thing.
So you've also started something to help out minority announcers. What's that about?
An announcer that I know, Adam Giardino, who was doing UConn and AAA baseball and other stuff, started the Black Play-by-Play Fund because there were only a couple Black Play-by-Play announcers in the country. There's over 200 jobs, right, in Major League Baseball, basketball, hockey, football, like even minor league baseball. And even though there's, you know, obviously a lot of Black players, there was not a lot of representation in the booth on the play-by-play side. So he felt like this was an inequity and that it was wrong. So he got with Dave Sims and Robert Ford and other people in the business and started like a three-prong thing where they provide a grant to a Black announcer that gets a minor league baseball job. These jobs are underpaid. It allows them to go into a market, Billings, Montana or whatever, and live for the summer, you know, give them $3,000 so they can make sure they pay the rent and go out and get that experience. And then they also provide scholarships for, you know, young Black announcers in college so they can work on their student radio station and maybe not have to worry about a part-time job that semester. And then they provide mentorship. And that's what I've been, you know, doing for an announcer at the University of Pittsburgh. His name is Alex Randall, who's a terrific hockey announcer. You know, I think he's going to be able to make it as a hockey announcer if he wants to do that. And it's just, you know, a way that I can, you know, give him some advice, you know, both life stuff and broadcast stuff. And it's rewarding for me, but it's a way for me to give back in that way.
That's wonderful. I mean, especially you're using, once again, your knowledge and your gifts and you're imparting it to someone and you're mentoring that person. Mentorship is, you know, vitally important. So before we conclude the show, Dave, I mean, you know, we've covered a lot of different topics, but it is the journey of giving back. And, you know, it meant so much you're willing to come on here on a Sunday morning and talk with us. But are there some things that, you know, you want to impart, maybe some pearls of wisdom, some ideas that maybe, you know, listeners can think about as, you know, they're listening and tuning in, also just, you know, evaluating their life about giving back?
Yeah, everybody's busy, right? And you feel like, okay, I have kids, I have two jobs, you know, there's always a way that you can give back. I'll just use Nutley Family Service Bureau as an example, right? We need people to volunteer at our events. You know, we had a volunteer appreciation event yesterday. Some people came and they set it up, they broke it down, they made sure that the volunteers had a good time. You know, Rock Hunger, we had a bunch of volunteers come and help with that. And people that help in the food pantry, you know, people that, you know, come out and give in some way at our thrift store, you know, that helps provide revenue for the organization. And there are people that do it 5 or 6 days a week. There are people that do one shift, you know, 3 hours a week or one event a year where they come and help. So whatever your bandwidth is and whatever your time is, there's something in your community that can use your help. And it'll make you feel good, right? It helps other people. And it creates connections, right? Life is about, you know, the human connection and whether it's just, you know, a kind word, you know, to the waiter that's serving you that morning, or, you know, the person that's washing your car in the morning. Be a human being and just give back throughout the day. It makes you feel better.
Yeah. You know, you also said before we conclude, being kind is not only fulfilling, but fun. And that's so important in life, too, is when you start to give back, you get so much more enjoyment out of it. So I just want to tell all the listeners, guys like Dave Popkin, wonderful people out there. He's using his God-given talent and ability to really make the world better. I ask all of you, if you know someone that's doing something special, tell them, contact Todd Leonard, me. Call the show, 973-920-7900. Follow us on Facebook. go on our website, ToddLeonardShow.com. We've had so many wonderful people on. Remember, we're all in this together. We're one big community. Enjoy this beautiful weather. Please tune in next Sunday.
The Todd Leonard Show is sponsored by the Leonard Foundation, whose mission is to support the children and families who are battling pediatric cancer and those in need of food and assistance, women's shelters, and other important social services in the community. They also proudly support those fighting pancreatic cancer. They feel it's vitally important to help those in need in our amazing community when they need us the most. Please join them in extending a helping hand and go to leonardcharity.org and donate now. Together, we can touch many lives.